This is episode number 753 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Connecticut Gamer Con, Spider-Man and Lois Lane, the 100th episode of Arrow, the Inkwell Awards, and our good friend Buddy Scalera's upcoming podcast. Our comics this week will be James Bond Hammerhead number 1, Batman number 11, Superman number 10, Prowler number 1, and Serenity No Power in the Verse number 1.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
God clean the whole for fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Lantenry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well, and now I'm the cultured Perrier drinker.
I know. I was shocked and amazed today when I came over here to record, and instead of pulling out a fresh can of Mountain Dew.
Yep.
From the refrigerator, you pulled out a bottle of Perrier.
Green apple. So I'm trying to cut down on my
soda. Please enlighten me. I can't wait to hear this story.
there's always some silliness that happens.
There's always some story of like.
So obviously trying to cut down on my soda intake, I've cut down to about 5 or 6 cans a day.
Now, the people who have listened to this show over any length of time, over the 10 plus years we've been doing this, this is not an uncommon conversation.
Yes.
To open the show where you talk about how you've cut down from a gargantuanly ridiculous amount of soda on a daily basis.
12 cans a day.
To still 3 times more than the average human consumes on a daily basis. But please continue.
So we were at work and there was a load of Perrier coming in.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason it shifted in the truck. So when the forklift went to get it, Perrier all over the dock, spilled everywhere. Not leaked, but just the bottles all broke open.
Uh-huh.
And as I'm over there picking them up, because I'm a good boss and I help my people.
Oh, yeah. It's super helpful.
I looked over and I saw Perrier Green Apple and I said, you know what? I'm going to give that a try.
Right. Because you can't sell it now.
No. But I didn't drink those there.
Oh, okay.
So we bought some at home. We bought some of our own. And I'm liking it. It obviously, I realized that I can't have something that has fake sugar or a little bit of sugar. I either need a ton of sugar or no sugar at all.
Uh-huh.
And this is very bitter, and it kind of helps the palate a little bit feel like there's something fizzy going in and going down, but I'm liking it. However, when it gets a little warm and if I drink too much of it, I feel like I'm drinking beer, and that's not a good thing.
No. I've never been – my wife is big into the sparkling water, seltzer water kind of stuff, and I'm not a fan.
I just don't like plain water. I need to have something more than that.
Yeah, see, I'm the opposite. I am although I will tell you right now, if you've got a 12-pack of Diet Coke laying around or Coke Zero or whatever, yeah. I've got no problem throwing that down.
Yep.
We just don't – no one else in my house drinks that, and no one gives a crap about me, so they don't ever buy that for me. Like that – we'll go to a party or something, or I'll go to a restaurant and I'll order a Diet Coke or a Coke Zero. But so we don't have it at home, but I am mainly a water drinker.
Yep.
Because I drink a lot of coffee.
Yes.
And in drinking coffee, I try to balance that out with plenty of water because obviously coffee dehydrates you.
Yep.
So, So there you go. That's more than you ever wanted to know about what you and I like to drink.
Yes.
And you have your Perrier. I have my bottle of water. I think we'll be good to go. You may have noticed that we did not put a show out last week.
Yes.
And that is because there's a lot of stuff that's been going on, including holidays, but also stuff going on in the real world. And,
yep.
That is generally the case this time of year for us.
Yep.
And as we get into the holiday season, that may be the case as well. So, you know, thank you for your patience. And it's been pleasantly surprising to see how many people are still downloading the show and that it's still going strong. So we totally appreciate that. And trust me when I tell you, when we don't get to sit down on Thursday and talk about comic books, That's a bitter pill to swallow.
Yeah, we get the itch. We're constantly wanting to do this. And just to let everybody know and thank everybody, my mother-in-law passed away last Thanksgiving or last week as we're recording this. So it was a very sad but very relaxing Thanksgiving for us because we were constantly waiting for this moment to happen. She was older. She's been very sick, and she passed away in her sleep right next to her husband of over 70 years. So you couldn't ask for any more than that. But it still took a little bit of a – it was a kick to us. I mean, we were sitting around with my father-in-law not knowing what to say.
Right.
And I was so appreciative of everybody reaching out and telling me how sorry they were and you know, people completely understand, which is great. Nobody said, dude, we still need a show. Show must go on.
Right.
Everybody is so supportive and loving, and it was really nice. And, you know, we've had a few of these tragedies come our way in the 10-plus years of doing this. We've never been shocked by anybody's behavior because it's always been just supportive and positive. So thank you on behalf of myself and my family.
Yes. As we've talked about many times, this community around the show has been flat out amazing, which as a in speaking of the community, I had a conversation, it wasn't on Thanksgiving, was it? You know what? Maybe it was Friday with our good friend, Buddy Scalera.
Yep.
Now, if you have not heard the interviews that we've done with Buddy Scalera before on the show, he was, back in the day, he's like a wizard historian because he was involved with Wizard back in the day. However, you would know him now more nowadays because of Comic Book School. So if you go to comicbookschool.com, Buddy, whenever we go to shows, whenever we go to New York Comic Con, whenever we go to big shows in the New England area, he is frequently doing a series of educational panels on creating comics. There's one specifically about comic creator connections that he does where it's like a meet and greet with other creators. Mm-hmm. And there have been some great collaborations that have come out of some of those panels. And he does interviews and stuff like that. But he had reached out to me because he was thinking about starting a podcast because he has a ton of old interviews, like dating back to the 90s and stuff like that and early 2000s of creators that he's recorded over the years. And he's, you know, we were talking about, he was thinking like, do you think people would be interested in hearing those things?
Yeah.
And I was like, holy crap, yes.
Yes.
I'm one of those people. Like mm-hmm. being able to go back in time and listen to someone do an interview about something before it ever came out, not knowing how it was going to be. Like imagine going back and talking about any of the big events that have happened in comics over the past 20 years, like before it actually happened.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, I've got this big storyline coming out and we'll see how it goes. And it turns out to be, you know, Civil War, or it turns out to be something else that ends up being really huge. So he's interested in doing that, and he's going to put a post on our Facebook page soon, because what he's looking for is someone to help him with the production side of things. Like he doesn't have the ability or the time right now to be able to take those old interviews, not only record, but then edit and produce the show and stuff like that. So he's going to be looking for someone who might be interested in being a part of that project to maybe help out with that project. And so you'll see that post coming up soon. But I have absolutely told him, yes, we want to hear those interviews.
Yes. Like,
for me, I'm a DVD extras sort of guy. I'm an inside the actor studio sort of guy. I want to, that's one of the reasons I love doing interviews when we go to shows and things like that. I want to hear from the person who's making the awesome thing, how they make the awesome thing.
Yes.
What was the process behind the awesome thing? And so that is what a lot of this podcast was completely built around, you know, over the years. So I'm excited about that, and I'm hopeful that he is going to, he's going to get that off the ground soon, and you should see something about that on the Facebook page if it's not up there already. So that's exciting news. We also want to remind people that Connecticut GamerCon is coming up the 1st and 2nd of April in 2017. That is our good buddy Mitch Halleck, who does Terrificon, is doing a GamerCon at ctgamercon.com, and more details about that show are continuing to come out, and he is putting together something pretty exciting over there. So I'm excited not only for Secret Identity, but I'm excited for Co-op Critics, because that whole site is all about games.
Yes.
And this is really a nice hometown gaming convention. And with the growth and sort of New York Comic-Conning of PAX, where you can't get tickets a couple hours after they go on sale, and it's an absolute zoo, and a lot of people get left out in the cold from that show, having another convention in the area that caters to gamers, I think, and primarily is about games, I think is really, really huge. So, and that's not to say that we don't have great shows that have gaming elements to them, but really having a gaming convention in the area is going to be pretty great. another gaming convention, Ananicon, is happening in the next couple of weeks, and you can go to ananicon.com to learn more about that. That's my buddy Max Saltonstall, and that is a tabletop gaming convention that is coming up as well. That is a small and super friendly show where if you want to go and play role-playing games for a couple days in a row, all day, all night, into the next day, like, that's the best kind of show to go to. And I lament every year now with my kid's schedule and everything else that I just can't go for the weekend and hang out and be there the whole time. But that show's been going strong probably for at least 8 or 9 years now, too.
That's something that when you said it, it just jolted me right back to the early days of Secret Identity.
Yep, there's a lot of good stuff happening around this time of year, which is generally a time of year where you think that it's the sort of the quiet season for stuff. But and there's also a Mike Carbonaro's Big Apple Con coming up, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's the 14th.
Yeah, so
I saw that one, and unfortunately, again, I have to reach out to Mike and say, you got to give me some notice because we want to do that show. We would love to do that because that is our origins right there.
And I think he might be doing it down at the pier.
Oh, that'd be perfect because that is, you know, it's a great place for a show. It really is.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with that. Other news this week, interesting sort of interview. We just mentioned like Inside the Actors Studio. Well, apparently there is Variety, the website, has a series called Actors on Actors, and it's sort of like Inside the Actors Studio. Well, they recently did an episode, and I'm going to read this article from Variety. It says, in Variety's Actors on Actors interview with Amy Adams, who plays Lois Lane in the DC movies, Andrew Garfield was the other actor. So they interview like each other. Andrew Garfield discussed the struggle he had coming to terms with big budget movies. Of course, he played Spider-Man in the two Amazing Spider-Man movies. He said, there's something about being that young in that kind of machinery, which I think is really dangerous, Garfield said of his time on the two Amazing Spider-Man films. I was still young enough to struggle with the value system, I suppose, of corporate America, really. It's a corporate enterprise, mostly. He went on to say that his experience taught him that story and character are ultimately not always on the top of the priority list. He said, I found that really, really tricky. I signed up to serve the story and to serve this incredible character that I've been dressing as since I was 3, and then it gets compromised and it breaks your heart. He said, I got heartbroken a little bit to a certain degree. Now, if that's not interesting enough, Adams added that she never feels like she owns the role of Lois Lane, especially given the multitude of incarnations of the character that have come before her. She said, that's the tricky thing with Lois that I find is I love playing her. I love everyone I work with, but sometimes it's tricky because I feel she's in service of the story instead of the story serving the character. That sometimes can be tricky when you show up and you really want to retain a character and you have to serve the story. In a perfect universe, they all work together. Now, she was kind of beating around the bush of saying the same thing as he was. But I think, you know, it's interesting in two respects. Because one, right, we knew that when Andrew Garfield got the call to be the next Spider-Man, we heard all about how he was a gigantic Spider-Man fan. So many times when you see these actors that get chosen to play these characters, they're not even comic book fans.
Yep.
They haven't read a lot of stuff. They do their research, which is fine. But when you see someone who's a diehard fan be able to play that role, like Ryan Reynolds with Deadpool, you know, like with Nicolas Cage, as cheesy as they have been, like him, but him being able to be Ghost Rider and almost being Superman and stuff like that. Like there is an element to that you root for that, right? Because here's this person who loves this character that you love and they get to do that. And being a huge Spidey fan, I wanted those movies to be awesome. And I enjoyed both of those movies. I will always be partial to the Raimi movies because A, it's Raimi, and B, the heart and soul of those movies to me are just phenomenal. I cannot wait for the next Spider-Man movie because I feel like I'm just trying to keep my expectations tempered. But it's interesting when you hear them talk about that, and much the same way with Lois. Like, Lois is completely underutilized and not well utilized in the DC movies, in my opinion. I'm sure that some will disagree with that, probably our good friend Daryl. However, she's a character who is a superhero in her own right, and is, when you think of Lois Lane, you think of World's Greatest Reporter, you think of Fearless. She needs more to do in those movies than to be another person who's being a downer for Clark. You know, there's enough people around Clark that are disappointed. Although if she's disappointed because she's not getting more story beats, I get that then. That's a good reason for her to be disappointed. But it's always interesting to hear the actors that have taken part in these big movies weigh in on what that experience was like for them. And it's unfortunate that with Andrew Garfield, his favorite character of all time is kind of a little bit tarnished for him now because those movies were not what he had hoped that they would be.
And if you remember when Andrew Garfield got the role, he ended up walking off set in the costume and going to play basketball with kids right down the street. I mean, he loved it. And it is, it's so sad when you hear that, when you get somebody, you know, I think of when Phil Jimenez, Wonder Woman's his favorite character, and his time doing the book was not the best time in his life.
Right.
And it's sad when you hear things like that.
If I could take the moments that I love from those Spider-Man movies that Garfield did are the moments where he is interacting with people on the street, when mm-hmm. he's interacting with kids. There are some moments in those movies that I teared up watching, that I was like, this is the Peter Parker Spider-Man that I love. If I could take those and bring those into the Raimi trilogy, like to me, that was one of the things that the Raimi trilogy maybe was missing, was the that kid piece.
The street level heart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That kind of stuff is to me like the heart and soul was there, but those little moments I felt like they kind of glossed over in the Raimi trilogy. It would be awesome to have that be those two things married together. So hopefully that's what we get with mm-hmm. this next movie, because I think it's Tom Holland, right?
Yes.
It's the new Spidey. From his performance in Civil War, holy crap.
That 5 minutes of, I want this now.
And then the after credit scene, like just yep. like all of it, love all of it, give it to me. I cannot wait. So, so yeah, always interesting. Another sort of actor playing a character that talking to the fans about stuff, Stephen Amell, posted on Facebook the other night because Arrow just had its 100th episode. As we just record the show, it was last night. It was part of the four-part crossover, which we'll probably talk about in the next show just because all four pieces will have been out by then. But he posted, he said, Facebook, I cannot believe our 100th episode is airing tonight because of the network we're on and the long shadows cast by the Vampire Diaries. He says, rip Brady the Werewolf and Supernatural, rip background character I will eventually play who is brutally murdered. He said, people might be inclined to think that 100 episodes come along easily. They don't. You have to be incredibly fortunate. Most importantly, you have to be surrounded by singularly talented crew and cast, directors and writers, executives, network and studio heads. He said, we are. We really, really are. We also have the incredibly unique and possibly unprecedented opportunity to celebrate the episode along three other shows that have helped populate the television universe into something magical. A four-night crossover, Aliens, what a treat. As it pertains to tonight's episode, there are three people that really warrant mentioning. Katie Cassidy is coming back to play an integral role in our episode while filming a movie in Boston. It's a testament to her work ethic and her integrity, both personally and professionally. She's magnificent tonight, and it was so much fun to run it back with her. Jamie Sheridan threw himself into the experience because being familiar with a character you haven't really played in 4 years in a workspace where everyone has such familiarity is no simple task. He made it look easy. And Susanna Thompson, when we lost Moira Queen on the show, the show lost a little bit of its soul. Simply put, this episode would have been incomplete and maybe even impossible to execute without the warmth she brings to every minute she spends on set. What a kind gesture by her return. The fans from all over the world, young and old, whether you discovered Green Arrow in the 1940s or you discovered the show somewhere between October 10th, 2012 and tonight, thank you. This experience has fundamentally altered the lives of more people than you could possibly imagine. What a ride. And as the caretaker of such a beloved character and the representative of such a rich history, I have always tried my very best to keep you entertained. I will continue to do so. Here's to another 100 episodes, Stephen Amell.
Wow.
Pretty nice. Awesome, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, Arrow was a show that famously, you know, we've talked about before, we came to very late.
Everybody, I won't say everybody, but most true comic fans kind of did. It seemed to be the looking for something different that came to it before. Because I remember people coming to me going, you're watching Arrow, right? Because it's a superhero thing. I'm like, I'm not watching it.
No, and the crazy thing is, like, the first season was amazing.
Yes.
And even the second season, and then it kind of stumbled in a little. I've always enjoyed the show. I like where the show is at right now, and I'm really enjoying it as it is today. But I came late to it.
Yep.
I came to it through The Flash, I think, I would imagine. And either that or did we do a watching project on it?
No, we did. I don't think we did. It was The Flash. Remember when they did that team up? Because that was right. The first show to do the team ups.
Right. And so, you know, going back and watching that show, it's been fantastic. I love it. And my son and I watched that episode last night, and seeing Katie Cassidy come back for that show and to hear that she was working on a movie and made time to come and do this particular episode, like, that's all very cool stuff. And again, shout out to our buddy Dan, who is really, I have no doubt in my mind that he is making a tremendous impact on mm-hmm. what we are seeing on the screen. No doubt in my mind. So when you're seeing things like Mon-El, and when you're seeing references to the Legion of Superheroes, and when you're seeing this Dominator storyline, like, there are some people behind the scenes now of these shows who really love the history of these characters and love the idea that they get to do this stuff on the TV screen. So it's yeah. super cool.
When you have a scene where Ma Huckle's helmet is in the background, that is not somebody that doesn't know the history of the characters. That's somebody that loves everything about this and respects the history and is giving us, the fans, all these giggle moments. I mean, every time they mention Big Belly Burger.
And it's easy to be jaded and think about what it isn't, right? Yeah. You know, it's so easy. And we talk about that all the time with Supergirl. Like, if you're not watching Supergirl, you're missing one of the greatest character arcs that I've seen on television in a very, very long time in Kara's sister, Alex Danvers. Fantastic. Mm. The whole Maggie storyline is absolutely wonderfully done, and the performances are absolutely amazing. And you hear people talk about the show like, oh, it's not dark enough, or it's cheesy, or it's whatever. We just lose perspective sometimes yeah. that we're actually getting to see. I mean, the fact that you have Monday through Thursday, Supergirl, The Flash, Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow is crazy.
And then throw Gotham in there.
I mean, we yeah, essentially...
It's insane.
We are now watching Saturday morning cartoons in prime time. That is what we have right now. We used to get up early in the morning, and we used to watch the Super Friends, and we used to watch Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Yep. We are now watching Saturday morning cartoons in prime time almost the entire week. That is freaking mind-boggling.
And we don't have to get up early on Saturday. That's the best part.
I mean, just like last night. Like, and again, it's a cheesy moment, but there's a moment where Flash and Supergirl are teaming up, and they take somebody down together. And it's like a tag team. They tag each other into this particular fight and stuff like that. And my son and I are just like giggling about yeah. that because it's freaking awesome.
I know we'll talk about it more next week, but the chemistry between those two, it almost seems like it's not acting. It really, these two, Melissa Benoist and Grant Gustin, there is such a chemistry with those two that it's just every time they're together, I get giddy. And we think about the ice cream cone scene from the first team up in the Supergirl episode when he brought her an ice cream cone and she had this look on her face.
Yeah.
That's every time they're together.
Yeah.
And
that's cool.
It's magical.
It's good stuff. Very, very cool. Congratulations on that show for reaching 100 episodes because, yes, as he said, it's easy to think about, you know, when you're on the CW because of Supernatural and Vampire Diaries and some of those shows that go on forever, that it's easy to get to that point, and it really isn't. And so, you know, kudos to them. I mean, if it wasn't for CW, we probably wouldn't have Supergirl right now.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. So there you go. That's your news. And, of course it is time now. Oh, one last thing about the news. It's Inkwell Awards season.
It is Inkwell Awards season. Now, Inkwell Awards celebrate the anchors. They celebrate the unsung heroes that are behind a comic. And to me, since we have been involved with the Inkwell Awards, I probably since day one of these awards, there is more of an awareness for me, and I know for you as well, when looking through the credits and looking through a book. When we see a solid anchor, when we see somebody that is doing just a fantastic job, we notice those things. And we've also noticed, sadly, in a lot of books that are usually going right from pencils to paint or to color,
right,
we're missing a lot of that stuff. So the Inkwell Awards celebrate the anchors. They celebrate what it is that helps bring comic books to life, to give them that third dimension, where you're not just looking at something that's flat. So we, once again, are part of the nominating committee. So we will be going through all of our comics from this last year, finding those anchors that have done a great job and nominating them for awards. And what we will say to you guys that are listening, if you have been reading something that maybe we haven't and you see an anchor that you think is deserving of a nomination, send the name. Let us know so we can take a look and we can send in really thick ballots because, unfortunately, it is sad that as the years have gone on, you're finding less and less anchors. And that's the part that really I struggle with. because I don't want to feel like it's part of a dying section of the comic book world, because it can't. It cannot be. And there's some great people out there, and we're going to be talking about a couple of them a little bit later. But if you see anybody, let us know.
So before we talk about comics, we always talk about beards. And if you go to VikingOilsLLC.com, you will see the latest offerings from Viking Oils. I am in the thick of growing my winter beard now.
It is.
And so I am going to have to be putting an order in soon, because I am going through that stuff like it is water. but yes, I use the beard oil, and it's absolutely amazing. And I'm getting a lot of comments on the beard, and they're all good except for my wife's.
Yes.
She's the only one that hates it. Everybody at work loves it. Oh, you look like this dude from Sons of Anarchy. I go to a metal show. Oh, nice beard, man. It's awesome.
Yep.
This is my favorite time of year, because I just grow the beard out the whole time. Everybody loves it except my wife and daughter. They're like, Dad, you look disgusting. Just shave that thing tomorrow. Like, it's so gross.
And Parker's looking, going, cannot wait. Can't wait till I
Parker
get the Viking
Parker can take it. Parker just looks at me like, what do I care?
Yeah.
Do whatever you want with your face, buddy.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me.
Just pick me up at 5.
Yeah.
Tuck me in at night.
Absolutely.
That's so all VikingOilsLLC.com, and you can like them on Facebook.
There you go. Now let's jump into comics. You are going to kick us off today with James Bond.
Yes. Now, last year it was announced that Dynamite would be doing a James Bond series. The first couple arcs have been done and complete. One of the things that I really enjoy and like what they're doing is that every arc will have a separate issue. So this is issue number one, although I believe it is maybe the second or third arc in this James Bond series. This book is written by Andy Diggle. Artist is Luca Casalaguida. Hopefully I pronounced that right.
I think you did all right on that one. That's just my vote.
Chris Blythe is the colorist. Simon Boland is the letterer. And the cover that I'm holding right now is the Francesco Francavilla cover.
Which is pretty much my go-to if I ever have an option. Because he does so many variant covers now, it's absolutely crazy. But if you don't follow him on like Instagram or Twitter, I'm just going to recommend that you go do that right now, because you're just going to be assaulted with amazing artwork 24/7.
And the other one that I struggle with, too, is when there's a cover is Robert Hack. Now, Robert Hack is the guy that I go to if you think Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every time he does a cover. However, they both did variant covers on this one.
It's a tough choice.
So it was
you can't be faulted for either one of those.
And the choice was made because this was the only one that was left at the store. So we start out in Caracas, Venezuela. And you've got a team that are guarding something. It looks like an abandoned building. And somebody comes down in a parachute and shoots the guard. And basically you see the back of their head explode as they get shot. So this book is not a rated G book. There's a little bit of violence in here. And as he lands, you see that it's James Bond. And this right now is when you're reading these, you are visually and seeing and hearing the trailer, the teaser, the pre-trailer teaser, which every movie has. And as he gets in there, he's following a signal, and he goes down a little bit further, and he's sneaking in, and you're seeing all these things that are going on right now. And something's happening, and it's just a great, you get the depth of how high he is as he's scaling down to these lower buildings. He puts a thing on the glass so he can hear what's going on. And you hear that there is a guy named, and I love this name because I know you're going to love it, Brian. The code name is Kraken.
Oh, I do like that.
Guy's name
is
Kraken.
It's a good code name.
So you have this guy.
As in Releista.
Yes, Releista. And he's like, look, man, I delivered it. And you see that this guy is, he's got dreadlocks. He's not necessarily the smartest guy, kind of coming across as a stoner. And he's like, you know, I delivered it, man, just like you said. You got to cut me some slack, man. And you see that. On the other side, that's Mr. Saxon is his name, and he is talking to the Kraken guy. And the Kraken guy is like, yeah, you failed me again, and this is not working out. And the guy's like, no way, man, that was gold dust, man. This is what you did. And, you know, you told me you wanted this done, and I took care of it clean. And you're seeing the two styles of – you sort of get what you would get if you hired a thug on the streets of any town USA talking to a sophisticated – guy that's looking for world domination. And you're just hearing, and that's what I was cracking up, because I don't know if that was intentional, but you are definitely seeing old style bad guy villain James Bond, and then what's probably out there right now. And all of a sudden the guy's like, by the way, you know, this cracking.
Are you saying that today's village just can't live up to the to the legacy of the old ones?
No, these guys are all idiots.
Yeah. We talk about the heroes so much, you know, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about the villains.
Yep. The villains have changed.
Yeah.
So this guy's talking, and as he looks at the computer monitor, he sees that something is going on, and Kraken basically says, yeah, you know what? I think you have out stage your welcome with me. But before that happens, there is a data breach, and there's a breach of the area. Somebody's pulling some stuff, and all of a sudden, James Bond comes kicking through. And I will say about the art that is really surprising is Luga's art is very much like if Francesco Francavilla drew this book. The style is exactly like his, and I'll show you that to the point when I first read it, because I usually don't read the credits until I'm done with the book because I kind of want to be surprised. I thought that he drew it. I was very surprised to see that he didn't. So a great fight scene for three or four panels. And then as everybody gets taken care of, you see this data purge is going on. And what is going on is this Kraken is now sucking out all the information out of these systems that James Bond has been there to take.
That's what Krakens do, man.
Krakens do. So Bond is now like, crap, I need to get the guy, because he's realizing that without any of the info, he cannot even get to this Kraken. So he's chasing the Saxon guy down. Saxon's running down this great old school stairway. Bond shoots him with a grappler, trips him up. And as he's hanging there, James Bond walks down and gets down to him. And he's like, you know, the Kraken, man, he made me do it. I had no choice. And he's like, so why don't you help yourself and help me by giving me a name? He's like, I can't. He's watching. You got to help me. You got to give me immunity. And then all of a sudden on his neck, he's got a scarf, but the scarf kind of peels away. And you see like this green light on a collar, which now all of a sudden turns red. And Bond realizes that that's not good. So he drops him. And then the dude explodes all over the place. Now we find James Bond at MI6 headquarters in London, and he's talking to M, and he is telling M everything that just happened. And M is saying to him, do you realize what you might have just done? And he's like, well, I went in and I took care of all this stuff. And he goes, yeah, you're telling me about this codename Kraken, this guy Saxon, but do you understand that Some data was stolen from one of the biggest companies in the world, the biggest military companies that is building stuff, Hunt Engineering. And the point and the problem is that the Lord Hunt, who's the CEO, is friends with the Prime Minister. So this has now become sort of a sticky situation. We need to figure this one out. And Bond's like, all right, well, I'll get right on it. And he goes, nope, you're not going to get on it. And he tells him that, you know, this needs to be taken care of delicately. You need to understand that you can't just go barging in. This is not the day and age of doing these sort of things. We have the mayor or we have the prime minister that is friends with this guy. So what you are going to do is you are going to go to this weapons convention and you are going to babysit Lord Hunt and keep him protected. So he flies out to the United Arab Emirates to the Dubai Arms Fair. And you see this fair, it's like the Big E, or any local fair, but instead of having cotton candy and hot dogs, you've got machine guns and weapons and missiles all over the place. So James gets in there and he's feeling a little discouraged about the whole situation, until he comes across this woman who comes up and says, oh, so are you the guy who's going to kind of help us out? And she goes, yep, I'm Bond, James Bond. And she says, I'm Victoria Hunt. And he says, you know, it's my father that has done this. And you have to excuse my father. He's with a sultan right now talking business. And we need to, he needs to take care of this. So I'm here to kind of walk you through what's going on. So as she's walking you through, you're seeing all these crazy weapons that are being developed. And they're watching this movie as it's going through, and they're talking about, you know, the proper helmet and the body armor that is made out of silk that is woven with steel and all these crazy things. And you're seeing how a handgun can be turned into a anti-personnel or anti-tank weapon. And you see somebody shooting a pistol at a tank and the tank blows up. And of course, Bond's comeback to that is business is booming. And then she brings him to the big weapon of the day, which is called Hammerhead. Now, it is a seated, it looks like a pistol, a huge pistol that is on a doom buggy. That's what it looks like. And she's explaining to him that this is sort of a weapon that can really do a lot of damage. And the muzzle velocity is Mach 10, which is a little quicker than the average things that we have right now. And it also has a 2,000-mile range. So that is a little troubling for Bond, considering that one of the things that was stolen out of from from the guy from Kraken is that it is, he stole nuclear warheads. So he's looking at this and saying, could this deliver a nuclear payload? And she goes, well, of course it can, but we only sell these weapons to our friends. And as he's saying this, you're seeing somebody up in the rafters coming down to maybe take a steal at this one. And she says, you know, she was saying something about, you know, and if friends should become enemies, then that's when it becomes a different situation. And that's why we have your department to help take care of this. And the last page of it, you see that the guy who is looking down is getting all the information about Bond, James Bond, secret intelligence, and what he is, license to kill, threat level high. You're getting all his stats and all these crazy things. But then that's where the story ends. So you are starting out with a very typical old school Bond movie where you have the action scene at the beginning, the story is coming up, and what I love about these, they're 5 issues, and then they're done, and then they move on to something else, and they restart the numbering. So Dynamite has done a great job with this one. I believe the last one was... It's out now? Varger, which is now out in trade paperback, so you can get that one as well. And that one was written by Warren Ellis, and James Masters did the art on that one. So they change up the teams. I believe they have a Felix Leiter miniseries coming out pretty soon, which is pretty interesting because that's a character that you only get in spurts. And the most I think you've ever really even seen him was in Casino Royale. That's probably the most screen time he ever had at one time. So great book. You ought to check it out if you like James Bond.
Well, switching over from James Bond, I guess the DC Universe's version, well, no, that's probably Grayson. All right, we're just going to talk about Batman, I guess is what I'm saying, Matthew. Have you been reading Batman?
Yes.
Okay, so you can help me fill in the blanks to some of the history here that I am not really that familiar with, but basically what we're going to talk about is issue number 11 today, which is part 3 of an arc called I Am Suicide. Now, the writer is Tom King, who's been doing an awesome job on this book. Mikael Janin is the penciler. Mikael Janin and Hugo Petrus are the inkers. Jun Chung colors. Clayton Cole's letters. Mikael Janin does the cover, and Tim Sale and Rico Renzi do the variant. Now, the editor is Mark Doyle, and the associate editor is Rebecca Taylor. Now, what has been happening here is, I believe, that because Gotham Girl, who is the only surviving member of the brother-sister team, was so mentally scarred by Psycho Pirate.
Yes.
And now Psycho Pirate has been not kidnapped, but bartered for by Bane. And Bane is in possession of Psycho Pirate. Batman has put together his own version of the Suicide Squad to basically go to the island that Bane runs and get Psycho Pirate so that he can bring him back to Gotham and help stabilize Gotham Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound
yep
right? So one of the people that he has recruited for, and in the last issue, in issue number 10, he had ran into Bane initially. Bane beat the crap out of him and dropped him in a hole, and it looked like he was done, but that was all part of Batman's plan. And he ended up escaping, and now he's got people that are infiltrating the sort of complex from 2 different areas now. And so as we begin this one, we get a flashback with Catwoman. Now, this is the part that I was kind of fuzzy on. Catwoman apparently has killed 237 people.
That was the part that I'm a little fuzzy on as well.
What I pieced together, and our Batman fans out there can help me if I'm incorrect, is that it sounds like there was a group that blew up an orphanage that she used to stay at in Gotham. And it was an orphanage that the Waynes had started. And this group that did this were 237 members strong. And so Catwoman went out and killed every single one of them because of what they did.
That's ringing a bell. And now why is it?
So in any case, that's my understanding of that. If that's different, then let me know. But it starts off with a flashback about him chasing her and them having a conversation about how she needs to make amends for the fact that she's killed 237 people. Then you can tell that she basically feels like it's a death sentence either way. If she gets taken in, they're going to kill her. You know, they'll give her the death penalty. If she doesn't get taken in, then there are people who are after her and she's dead either way. So Catwoman seems like she's in a very dark and precarious place. Well, lo and behold, she is one of the people that he has recruited for this particular mission. He's also recruited the ventriloquist.
Mm.
And so what you have here is a scene where Batman, who has now escaped from the hole that he was thrown in and is mucking about in the complex that Bane owns, has met up with Catwoman and Wesker, and he's saying, this is the plan. I'm going to go this way. I'm going to get into the duct system. You guys have to go here. We're going to meet at this point in time. It's very important that we keep Wesker safe, because Catwoman's like, why are we taking this guy with us? Let me just go do my thing. And he's saying, he's the most important piece. If we don't have Wesker, if we don't have the ventriloquist, we don't get out of here alive. So don't let anything happen to him and make sure that he is with you when we have to enact the plan. And so they split up and Batman goes and does his thing. And it becomes apparent almost immediately that Catwoman is not going to follow the plan that Batman has laid out for them. But what the coolest part of this whole issue is, and then you have Punch and Julie.
They are insane.
Who are basically like if Harley Quinn was cloned into a male and female version of herself. They're just insanely in love with each other and just completely bonkers. And they are with Bronze Tiger, and Bronze Tiger is doing the old Han Solo Chewbacca ruse where he's bringing them in to give them to Bane, when in reality they're gonna, you know, spring a trap on them. So those are the two teams that we have working to get into.
And that would have been
complex.
The Princess Leia bringing in Chewbacca as
right,
Bush
right.
the Bounty Hunter.
Right, of course. So thank you for correcting that, so we didn't have to get 100 emails.
That's
about
what I was worried
I appreciate
about.
That. So I always think of it as the Chewbacca ruse.
Yes.
But so you get a little snippet of them, and yes, they are madly in love with one another and pretty much mad in general. And they get taken in. They're going to go see Bane because Bronze Tiger is saying, I captured these guys, and Punch is the only guy who's ever escaped your prison here. And so I'm bringing you the guy that escaped from you, and I'm also bringing the person that he went to escape to go find. So I'm delivering them to you in order to gain favor with you, because what he is telling Bane is that I have a contract to kill Batman, and you're the only dude who knows how to take out Batman. So I give you these guys, you tell me how to kill Batman, everything's cool. That's my payment. So that's his plan as he's going in. But that's not the coolest part of this book. The coolest part of this book is the very middle of the book, which is a two-page splash of Catwoman and the ventriloquist making their way through this pipe system in order to get in position for Batman to spring his trap. And there's this awesome conversation that happens over an open, no panels, an open two-page spread. And again, the artwork here, you have Mikael Janin, you have Mikael Janin and Hugo Petrus who do the inks, and you have June Chung who does the colors. Absolutely wonderful. This two-page spread is just freaking awesome. And it's Catwoman saying to Wesker, you know, we're alone now, so I just have to ask you something. He says, oh, well, you can ask me anything you want, Catwoman. So this puppet that you have, and he says, Scarface. Yeah, Scarface, whatever. He's just like you, right? And he's like, I don't understand what you're asking me.
Yeah.
Well, he's just an extension of you. Like, that's all you. And he's like, oh, no. No, that's completely separate. And he says, hey, Scarface isn't me. And she's like, well, what are you talking about? And he says, yeah. She says, listen, there's no police here. Just tell me. And he says, oh, no. Scarface is a monster. I'm not a monster. And he says, when Scarface isn't around, I'm better. And that's, so it's him. It's not me. He makes me do terrible things, but that is him. It is not me. It's not an extension of me. We are two completely separate beings, and he's a monster. And when he's gone, then I'm just a regular dude. And Catwoman says, well, that must be nice for you. Nice that your monster comes and goes. You get a happy little break now and then. She says, mine has her claws firmly stuck inside of me, and that mangy little lynx never lets go. And I just thought that was an awesome scene where you have Catwoman who is grappling with these things that she's done and grappling with the dynamic of her relationship with Batman and how they just can't ever seem to find happiness and all of these sort of conflicting things that she deals with on a daily basis. And here you have this other guy who's basically like, yeah, as long as I don't have that puppet, I'm completely, you know, or the ventriloquist dummy, I'm completely fine. And you could tell that she wants that. You know, she wants to be able to put her monster in a box and put it away and not have to deal with it. But so they make their way through the duct system and, you know, he's saying, well, Batman said we should go find Psycho Pirate. We should probably go do that. And she says, you know, they're going to put a needle in me. And this is what she's saying to Wesker. Like, they're going to kill me one way or the other. Batman thinks this mission can stop it, because the deal with these guys, I think, is that they get either a pardon or they get reduced sentences or whatever the deal is that they made. But whatever Batman's promised her, you know, about her having lesser consequences or avoiding consequences, she doesn't believe that that's going to actually happen or that he's even capable of making that happen for her. So she takes off. So now we have the bit play out where Bronze Tiger comes in and says, hey, I'm delivering these guys to you, and I'm just doing it out of the goodness of my heart because I need information from you. And Bane sees right through that. Now, Bane is a venomless Bane now. So he's not dude with hoses hooked up to the back of his head. He's just dude.
Yeah.
Pretty strong dude, pretty mad dude, but just dude.
Took me a little bit to get used to that.
Yeah. So he beats the crap. And he grabs Bronze Tiger, or he's about to grab Bronze Tiger, and then Catwoman comes in. And this is where Catwoman screws up the whole plan. She comes in and kills Punch and Julie. Takes her claws, slits both of their throats. Yep. For all intents and purposes, looks like they're not going to make it. Then she puts her whip around Bronze Tiger's neck, and it looks like maybe snaps his neck too. And she's explaining to Bane as she does this, Batman's actually here. He escaped your little trap. He's in the building. He's got people with him. They're going to try to break out Psycho Pirate. And I'm here to stop that from happening. And he says, all right, Catwoman, what's next then? And she says, next, you give me a plane. You give me money. You help me disappear. And in exchange, I will tell you how you can finally break the bat. And so Catwoman has come to the conclusion that whatever Batman's promised her at this point, he's not going to be able to deliver on. Her best bet at getting away clean and being safe is to essentially barter for that with Bane and screw up Batman's whole plan. And so that's the way the issue ends. So pretty cool twist. The moment in the middle with Wesker and with Catwoman, I thought was just a great character moment for both of them. And so that, to me, made the whole issue worth checking out. This particular arc, I haven't enjoyed as much as I did the first arc of the book with Gotham Girl and Gotham, but it's still pretty darn awesome. And Tom King is still writing the heck out of Batman. And so I'm excited to see how this one's going to finish. But
my favorite moment in that book was the times when right after Batman and Catwoman had a throwdown. And I guess she tore her meniscus or ACL?
Her ACL or something. And he said, well, I knew you weren't going to make that jump. And she's like, well, you could have told me.
You could have told me. There were some moments in there where you just felt her wanting to be a good person. Like that whole part of the conversation, it's like, yeah, you just killed a whole lot of people. I know, but can we just go back to the way things
were?
Well,
and her basically, to me, one of the constant struggles between the two of them is that Batman sees things in a very sort of black and white kind of way sometimes. And so her struggling to come to grips with that, you know what I mean? That he and him saying, there's a moment in the book where he says to her, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
You know, like, what, this is the position you've put me in. Like, what would you have me do here? So
staying with the DC universe and for a little bit staying with Batman, for my favorite book each month since the start of the DC Universe Rebirth, Superman. This is issue number 10. This is one that I was waiting for from the second I saw the cover. Could not wait to get this one. The creative team on it is Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason are the writers. Patrick Gleason does the pencils. Mick Gray does the inks, who is my nomination for an Inkwell Award this year because he does such a great job. And we have this one. It's called Part 1, World's Smallest. And I love that it's written in the logo of World's Finest. So what this story is, and I didn't get the cover I wanted, where you had Batman and Superman kind of squaring off, and right underneath was John and Damian. I got one where Superman's choking Batman, which is still pretty cool. But you start out with it's getting ready for Christmas break, and John is leaving school, and he's got his new friend, the girl that lives down the street from him. And they're talking about, you know, oh, this is what we're going to do. And then this kid comes up going, oh, what's up there, Blondie? You want to get under the mistletoe? And this kid's kind of the bully. A teacher comes out, Mr. Martinez, who's, I think, the science teacher, comes out and starts talking to him. He's like, you know what, guys, just get out there and enjoy your Christmas break and just have a lot of fun. And then he takes the kid, I think he takes him down to the office. And then all of a sudden, as they're leaving, the two of them get knocked over by somebody. And it's this young girl who is, you don't know who she is. She doesn't even give a name. But the thing is, I remember thinking, wow, she kind of looks like the girl that hangs out with Damian Wayne. I just can't remember her name. And she's got superpowers. And all of a sudden, the two of them are like, oh, are you a new student here? And she's like, no, I'm a nobody. I'm just running an errand for my little brother. See you later, John. Bye. And then leaves. And they're like, well, what is she running an errand for in a school? And then she's hearing, you know, like you hear report. And she goes, okay, school food's the worst and I hate you. Okay, on Superboy, no incidences. So you see that somebody's spying on Superboy. And as the two of Superboy and the girl, they're riding bikes on the way home, they're going through a swamp. They're going through all the crazy places, scaring each other. And then it's a spooky swamp. So then John goes, all right, looks like a job for Superboy to go check this out. Because he sees some things going on. So as he walks around, he goes up to an owl, and this owl has glowing eyes, and he freaks out about that one, and then a snake comes after him. Now, Jonathan is not in control of his powers yet. They're very intermittent, so he right. might have – he might be able to jump up 50 feet in the air.
Well, didn't he fry their own cat?
Yes.
It was the cat, right?
Yep, it was the cat. So he might be able to have powers to jump up into a building 50 feet in the air, but he can't jump down and land because the powers aren't manifesting properly yet. So as he goes up to grab an owl, he's realizing the owls aren't right. A snake's there, and the snake has glowing eyes, and he's like, get it under control. And now he's eye-beaming the woods. The woods are starting to catch on fire. And as he looks up, he sees this, like, mutant, nasty, zombified looking moose. And then all of a sudden somebody grabs him and pulls on him. And as he looks up, somebody is drawing him up in the sky and saying, you know, I can't believe I'm even here. You know, compared to you, I look like Wonder Woman. And he's like, what's going on? And you see that it is Goliath and that girl that are pulling John up from the ground. And Damien is up there with him. I'm sorry, he's not even up there with him. He's just kind of talking through the girl that she's kind of telling him what's going on. And so as this is happening, Superboy's kind of freaking out a little bit. He doesn't know what's going on. He accidentally blows, like sneezes and blows cold, and it freezes Goliath, the girl, and they start crashing to Earth. And then when they finally land, they get up, and John is got probes on him. You see a syringe going in him, and you look down, and it is Damien. And Damien is screaming at him, going, you know what? You know, you can't believe. You think you've earned this? You did not. I've earned this. I've earned this birthright. And he's screaming and yelling at him. And then John is like, yeah, what is going on here? And then you see that he is in the Batcave, and it's Batman that has brought him there after Robin wasn't so kind to him and brought him in, and he's there. And he's now you've got Batman saying, you got to back off. This kid's been hurt, and you had no right to do this. So Damien is not letting up. And as he's talking to him, he's like, you know what? My dad would never do anything like this. And he goes, well, my dad would. And then Batman's like, look, you two just need to shut up, enough of this. Then all of a sudden, you get very mad. Superman coming through the Batcave in a way that's not normally there. He is burning his way through. He lands there, and before he gets there, he's like, Batman's like, whoa, whoa, Superman, let me explain. Superman does not want to give him a chance. He's like, if you have hurt him, and then Superman or Superboy is going, Dad, don't hurt him. I'm fine. Trying to calm these two down. But there is a great moment right here, and I'll show you that panel, Brian, with the four of them squaring off. And now you have the kids that are kind of like, hey, dads, back off a little bit. We don't want this to happen. This is not what we meant. So then they have kind of a quiet moment. They start talking about things that are going on. And all Superman is worried about is, hey, I'm just worried about my son. He went missing. I found him here. I see him tied up. I see a syringe. I'm not liking this. So now Batman and Superman decide that they need to do something about the two of them, that they both have kids that are in need of training. And they're thinking, well, you know what? Maybe the two of them can help each other. And that's not the case. Maybe John can help, but Damien cannot, because Damien is very, very forceful. He's very this. You've got Alfred shows up with root beer, and you just see John like, oh my gosh, root beer, thank you so much. This is great. And Damien is like, my tea, Pennyworth. So you're seeing how that is even there. And then you got Batman looking at Superman going, okay, so your son's a little more innocent than mine is, so we need to work on this one. And then what happens for the next couple pages is that Damien is showing him around. He introduces him to Bat-Cow. They're going through. He introduces him to the cat. All these things that are going on. But when he picks up the cat, he says, oh, here's our cat. You wouldn't want to make your mama cry again, would you? Kind of throwing it in his face that he killed the cat. And then you're thinking, how did he know about killing of the cat? So as they decide, as Jonathan punches Damien right in the stomach, the two of them start to have a battle. The cat jumps on Damien's, on Jonathan's face. They start going at it. Alfred kind of breaks them up. And then Superman and Batman show up and the two of them look over and you see like just that squinty look Batman face with no expression, just the eyes and the outline. And it says next issue boot camp. And I will tell you that I wanted to review the second one because I thought issue 11 was even better than that one because it was just training out of control. They basically threw him out in the woods and said, yeah, find your way back, but you need to help each other.
Yep.
And they don't learn the lessons that they need to. And you almost end it with, I don't know if these two are ever going to learn, but fantastic. The cool thing is DC, in the next couple of weeks, are going to be releasing hardcover collections of the first five or six issues of each of the series. And if you haven't read Superman, if your store does not have the issues, pick it up. This has been one of the most enjoyable series that I've read probably in the last 3 or 4 years. I've really loved where they're going with this one, the heart of it, the soul, the characters, and having Superboy in there as a young kid is perfect.
All right, well, I'm going to jump back over to the Marvel Universe for a book that I kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit about picking up, but I'm glad that I did. It is Prowler number 1, and this series is written by Sean Ryan. The layout artist is Javier Salteras. The artist is Jamal Campbell. Letters by Corey Pettit. And the editor on this one is Devin Lewis. Now, you have Hobie Brown is a guy who is sort of a villain turned buddy of Spider-Man. And there have been times over Spider-Man's career where he has asked Prowler to basically impersonate him. And that has happened again recently where because Peter Parker is the CEO of Parker Industries and he has to be all over the place and he's kind of playing this international role now, there have been times where he, of course, wants to be seen in the same place as Spider-Man so that nobody thinks that he's Spider-Man. And so Hobie has been helping him with that. And that's a role that he has played at some point in the past. So what happened recently is Hobie, as Prowler, had stumbled upon what was going on with the Jackal. He had stumbled upon new U technologies, and he had figured out that there was the whole cloning operation going on. Well, there is a new Electro in town, and she is the girlfriend or one-time love interest of the old Electro. She actually killed Prowler. And so what the Jackal has the ability to do is to bring people basically back to life in a body that is completely healed of any injuries that they had, except they are now beholden to him because they have to take this medication every single day. And if they don't do that, then their body starts to quickly fall apart. But what's been interesting about the Jackal is that everyone that he has done this to, or everyone that has sort of sided with him so far, he has been able to convince that this technology is going to be used for a good reason and that his mission is good and that he's not a villain. And so what you have as you open up this particular story is you have in San Francisco, you have Prowler, who's now dressed as himself again, who is breaking up a bank robbery. And it's like first thing in the morning, and he breaks up this bank robbery, and he heads back to New U Technologies. And when he gets back there, you have these C-list villains that are fighting one another. So you've got Jack-O-Lantern there, you've got the new Electro there, you've got a bunch of other villains there, and he comes in and he has to break it up. And the Jackal shows up, who does not look like the green furry guy anymore, but he looks like a very svelte-looking dude in a nice suit and an Anubis mask. And we haven't seen the identity of this Jackal yet. I still think it is Ben Reilly, but that's just my dark horse pick for what that is. But in any case, he comes out and he says, can I talk to you for a second, Prowler? And he brings him into his office and he says, look, you know, you believe in what we're doing here, right? And Prowler says, yep, I do. You know, I'm here to help. And he's been made the head of security at New U Technologies. Keep in mind, the Jackal has never told us, the reader, what his plan is. We don't know why he's doing this. We don't know what the big deal is. We just know that people are buying into it. So you have Prowler saying, yeah, yeah, no, I'm on board. And he says, well, one of the things that you have to do is you have to keep these degenerates from fighting with each other all the time because everybody's important here. Everybody has a role to play. Where were you this morning? And he says, well, I had heard from Madame Web, because Jackal has resurrected Madame Web, that she had seen a vision of a bank robbery that was happening. So I went out and Jackal's trying to explain to him, like, you can't just leave the premises without asking me. You have to let me know what's going on because I need to know where you are at all times. And if you're on board with the mission that we have here, then you really need to kind of pay attention to that. And he says, all right, well, I agree to that. And he says, but I understand that you have this need to go out and do good, that you have this need to, you can't sit around here all the time. You need to go out and sort of work out some energy. So there is someone that has been trying to hack into our systems lately, and Madam Webb has been trying to help me track them down. Why don't you follow up on that? That's the thing that I want you to be doing. And he says, okay. So he goes and sees Madam Webb, and it was cool just to see Madam Webb again. And she's got that, you know, she's got the blindfold on, and she's got the web thrown behind her, and she's got the cool spider dress that she wears. And he's talking to Madam Webb, and apparently Madam Webb's on board with this whole thing too that the Jackal's doing. But she's been trying to see who it is that's been hacking into their system. And she says, all I see is it's this place where it's great despair. It's sort of out isolated from everything else. It's surrounded by black. It's a collection of buildings. They're empty but filled with agony. And he's like, okay, I guess I'll go follow up on that. Well, as he ends up going out to, you know, do some investigating, you get sort of a backstory of his, who he was, how he was the scientist, and he, you know, and he turned bad for a while, but he also worked with Silver Sable for a while, and he worked with Spidey and all this stuff. So you get sort of Prowler's backstory, which is kind of cool. And then you see that the place that she's been seeing in her visions is Alcatraz. So, because they're in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And so he ends up going out there because something is going on at Alcatraz, and he's going to go and find out what it is, because whatever it is someone who's trying to foil the Jackal's plan. And so he gets there, and he sneaks into Alcatraz, and he ends up getting caught by someone. And as the first issue ends, you don't see who he's caught by, but just that he is completely at this person's mercy. And that's the way the first issue ends. So, I mean, what I liked about this issue is you get the backstory of Prowler. He's out on his own now. He's got his own story where he's just been a supporting character in Spidey's book up until this time. The problem is that the first issue is not super exciting. It doesn't have anything that really propels you into the next issue of, I need to pick this up. Yeah. This is just an amazing story. So I'm going to get the next issue, but it wasn't like a home run out of the park first issue. But still pretty cool. And it's loosely tied into Clone Conspiracy. So if you're following that and you're picking up all the side stuff, then Prowler is tied to that as well.
So one of our favorite properties of all time, and I think a lot of the listeners will agree, is Serenity. We love Serenity. We love Firefly.
We did a summer watching project on Firefly, did we not?
I believe we did.
And that was awesome.
One of the greatest.
Might have been our first summer watching project.
It is one of the greatest single seasons of television you'll ever see in your entire life. If you've never seen it, you need to get out there. So Dark Horse, every year or so, sends out, you know, a couple issues of a series, and they've got the series now, No Power in the Verse. And it's written by Chris Roberson, pencils by George Gentry, who you would remember, Brian, from his amazing work on Buffy.
We just lost Shepherd Book.
Yes. Yep, Ron Glass just passed away this past week. Carl Story does the inks. I was going to mention that in here, too, because we did lose three. We lost him, Fidel Castro, and Florence Henderson. Three people that you would never expect to be in a room together ever.
That's true.
In the history of ever. So, yeah, so we lost Book. Very sad, sad, sad that that happened. And a cover by Dan Dos Santos. And I will show you the cover, Brian. Amazing.
You know what? The covers that they do for that are like these photo, not photorealistic, but very, very sort of realistic painting style covers. And they do a nice job with it. They do a lot of that with Buffy too.
Yep.
And it's always great.
Yep. So this is part one of six. And you have somewhere in the verse, you've got the Firefly is outside. And it's kind of waiting. And you see it going on. And you got Mal inside, who is now going, oh, seems like your luck's kind of changed, and ours hasn't. Or ours, your luck has gone bad, ours has gone good. So you see that Mal is in there trying to steal something. And he's like, all right, the door should be open right about now. And all of a sudden, you've got, who was Wash's wife? Zoe. So you got Zoe and Jane, and they're coming through, and they are going to go over, and they've opened up sort of a airlock or something, a cargo area, and they're stealing cargo. And you see the two of them just taking cargo from this one ship over to the Serenity. Is it a Firefly class ship, Serenity? Yes.
Yes.
Not the other way around. So they get everything in there, and as they are getting ready to go, they get everything in there, and you've got Kaylee who's there with the doc, and they've got Zoe and Wash's baby, Emma, and River's holding the baby. And as they come in, they start to take off, they get going, they break away, and when they go in, they realize, or Jane, who is very hot-headed, walks up and he goes up to one of the things and he goes, what was this that was so important? And is this going to get us some money? Is this going to get us some stuff we need? And he opens it up and you see that it is toilet paper. They're smuggling toilet paper now. They're stealing toilet paper and smuggling toilet paper.
Toilet paper is important.
And although it is very important, like you said, because everybody starts saying it, Mal storms off because he realizes that this is what his life has become. He's not the adventurer. He's not saving the day like he wants. Or trying to write
a glorious tale of battle that you're going to tell in a tavern someday.
Yeah, he's stealing toilet paper. So now you go down and you have Inara who is talking to a friend of hers. Now, if you don't know the story, Inara is a prostitute.
Like escort?
No, that could be
it's
a better
not
term.
Even. It's
I forgot the term that they used.
Yeah.
But basically, she worked in a madam's house. And in space, it wasn't that big a deal. It's not like it has that stigma, but it does for Mal. And Mal has finally come to that realization that if he's going to be with her, he's got to deal with her past and what was going on. And they seem to do that because they have a relationship going on right now. But she's talking to a friend of hers. And later they end the conversation. They go in. They start having some, you know, quiet moments with each other. You're seeing the rest of the crew. You've got Zoe who's mad at Jane because he left an airlock open and Emma could have wandered out there. And then as they're talking, all of a sudden you see baby Emma up on a scaffolding. She starts to fall. And as she's falling, River comes out, jumps, does this triple Lutz flip, saves the day. And then you see Jane just being completely destroyed and upset about that. And as he's in the weight room
Companion.
Thank you. As he is working out, you see he and Jane – Jane and Mal are talking like he's remembering the two of them talking in better moments when things were better. So as they're all sleeping and relaxing, all of a sudden, Inara gets a message from this girl named Iris. And she's like, I need your help. You need to come to us. So then they return to the planet where she was a companion. And she's meeting her friend. And she's like, you know, you got to help because B's gone. And they're like, OK, well, let's figure this one out. Let's go. We'll take care of this one. So they tell the story. They see what's going on. They find out maybe where she could be. And as they head over there, they head over to this other part. Now, the cool thing about this whole civilization is that in the future, it's a Wild West, but with a very Mandarin Chinese flavor to it, that you're almost watching like Wild West Chinatown is in space is the way that this looks. So they're talking about how they need to go down and fight this gang. They realize what gang that she might have gotten taken by. And one of them swears in that Mandarin, like all the swears, if you remember, would always be in Chinese, because that became the language of space. And they're saying, you know, they find out where she is. And as they break into this hall where they're going to go find her, that's where things start to get a little ugly because they go in and you see a lot of these young women recruits are very angry and very mad and going to use guns and take care of the situation. And that is where this issue ends. Great issue. Great to have these back. I know where I'm not a Buffy fan, but I know when Buffy fans were getting the comics and they were real feeling like
still
this
going.
Is the rest of our season. This is what we're not ever going to get again. It's great that they're doing that with Serenity because, again, this is something that we're probably never going to see again. Seeing Mal on Modern Family. Why am I forgetting?
Nathan Fillion?
Nathan Fillion is on Modern Family now.
Really?
He's dating the oldest daughter.
Oh.
Fantastic. Huh. It is awesome. He's a weatherman. And everything he does is always, you know, when I say chance for success. And, you know, everything is like a weather thing to him or some TV pitch point. But it's an amazing series. It's any bit that we get.
When you think about the fact that more people know him now outside of our circles, know him for Castle.
Yep.
Than know him for Firefly and Serenity.
Yep. Or Two Guys, a Girl in a Pizza Place. Which
that's
is
true.
Where I discovered him.
That is where I discovered him as well.
So check it out. And that is something I don't even know if that's out on TV because Ryan Reynolds was on that. I would love to see some of those.
Yeah. I don't think it is, but maybe somebody has. You know what? Maybe when you go to some of these comic book shows, somebody's got the old bootleg of Two Guys, Girl, and Pizza Place.
Yep. We'll talk to our old buddy Mike, who I don't think does it anymore.
Well, you never know. There's a Big Apple show coming up.
Mike might be
the place
to
check it out. So there you go. That is going to do it for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. For Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. I hope you had a wonderful holiday. I hope you have a wonderful holiday season. We will be back again next week. And as many weeks as we can during this season.
Yes.
And we thank you for your patience with more ridiculousness. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.